fall on my knees. Tell me how's the way to be. Tell me how's the way to go. Tell me all that I should know. And I'll fall on my knees. Tell me how's the way to go. Tell me how's the way to be. To evoke some empathy.
Welcome to the roundtable for this Tuesday. It is the 18th of November, and it's very nice to have you with us. Hopefully you're going to have a great day. I think it's going to be a great day. I just have that hunch. It's going to be a fantastic day. As I said during the billboard this morning, on paper today's show, great show. We've got all of you. We've got the three of you who I'm going to introduce in just a few minutes. And then we've got book picks, which is fantastic. We have the one and only John Irving on today talking talking about his work, which is fantastic. And I don't know if any of you have seen this show on Netflix called Boots, but there's a show, Boots, which is about a Marine
corporal?
I want to say training camp, but no, boot camp.
Oh.
A Marine boot camp. And yes, corporal. And so there's this young, this is before Don't Ask, Don't Tell, and a young man who goes into the Marine Corps. He's gay, and he goes in sort of on a lark with his best friend. And what happens, it's a true story, and the guy who actually lived the story will be with us this morning to tell us. But it's I think it's the number one show on Netflix, and it's very, very good. And so we'll talk about that later.
So that means people are going to have to sit around and listen to us so that they can get
to
the good stuff.
No. What I'm saying is it's a three-hour jam-packed mega show. That's what I'm saying.
I'm sorry. That's what I thought you said, Kevin.
All right, let's get to it. We welcome some wonderful panelists this morning. Chief of Staff and Vice President for Strategy and Policy at Bard College, Malia Dumont is with us. Good morning, Malia. How are you?
Good morning. Well, speaking of good days, I just want to share to get us off on the right foot today. I had a really wonderful day this weekend. One of my favorite days of the year is Service Academy Nomination Day. This is when I get to help interview young people who are applying to attend one of our nation's military academies.
Oh, yeah.
And it is so inspiring. It always gives me a lot of hope about the future. And these young people are just incredible and really dedicated. I was also struck this year by the number of people who are applying who, when asked why they want to go to Service Academy, talked about their families. Many of them come from immigrant families or immigrants themselves and talk about, this country gave my family so much opportunity and I want to give back. And that's why they want to go to Service Academy and serve in the military. So it was a great day and really inspiring. And there's a lot of hope for the future, despite what we might feel around us sometimes.
And this is for young people who are just starting their journey.
Right.
Going into the academies.
Right, exactly. They're in high school now, or in some cases they're looking to transfer from another college and want to go to West Point or the Naval Academy, the Air Force Academy, or the Merchant Marine Academy.
Well, bless them. Thank you. That seems really inspiring.
It is. It's a wonderful day.
Well, thank you for doing that. We welcome Jim Henler to the program, Acting Department Head of Cognitive Science, Tetherless World Senior Constellation Professor of Computer, Web, and Cognitive Science. Jim Henler. Good morning, Jim. How are you?
I'm doing good. Lee, it's good to hear. I gave a couple of lectures probably before you were born down at the Air Force Academy, and it was always really inspiring.
They were in black
to see.
And white.
Let's just say anyone who was there when I was there is now either retired or a four-star. So,
or the third option.
Or the third. Actually, very few. Luckily, very few of them. The third option.
Yeah, good, so, excellent.
Anyway, but yes, these are very amazing people, and you know, just so as long as we're plugging these kind of things, I was down at the National Academy of Public Administration, where we're talking about exactly the issue of how do we get young people to decide that service to the country through, you know, becoming involved in the governmental systems is still a good idea. And, you know, on one hand, it was inspiring to see people who still are saying, despite everything, we need to go in. It was a little disconcerting because the speakers had all been picked 9 months to a year ago. And so now almost every one of them is the former deputy of X, the previous administrator of Y. But, you know, it's really clear there are very significant and very, I don't even know what, inspiring people who are willing to, you know, they leave the government, they're almost immediately hired by private industry for 3-4 times the amount of money they were making. And the fact that they're willing to serve, put their lives at the service of the country. And I'm not talking lives in the same sense as the military, but it's a different way of thinking about it. You're agreeing that, you know, I'm going to be on the Bureau of Labor Statistics, and I realize I'm never going to make as much money as I would make if I went into a bank, but these statistics are important to the Americans being able to do the right thing.
I hope we all,
and we'll get to that later,
continue to remember that over time and it doesn't get washed away. J.P. Miller is with us. He is the man responsible for the Empire Report. Good morning, sir. How are you?
Good morning. I'm great, Joe. How are you doing?
I'm well. Yeah. Nice to see you.
Great to see you.
Anything
Thanks
going
for
on?
Me. There's something. Have you ever heard of Cloudflare?
Yes.
Oh, of course.
Yes.
So Cloudflare went down this morning. And Empire Report is run on Cloudflare. So, you know, I'm there doing my thing. I'm having a nice day. I'm excited to come and see you all. And then, you know, the site comes down. But it's kind of interesting. All right, so my site goes down, but it's not really my fault because it's Cloudflare. So you're in good company. Amazon was down. Twitter was down. So that's how my morning. But it's a weird thing. I'm not happy it's down, but I'm happy that it's not my server that's down.
Well, that's true. Yeah, because there's really nothing you can do about it.
That's
right. It's not like you're going to go pick up the wrenches and head down to headquarters or.
Yes. I called my wrench guys and they said, look, Cloudflare is going to fix it before we can. Just hang tight. They're on it.
And the good news is this one doesn't seem yet like it's affecting the airlines. The last one.
Well, there we go. They've had enough problems over the last couple of weeks. All right, let's start off. Jim made the note when we came in that today seems to be the day that we're actually sticking with the stories in which we're intended, which is a rarity. Although I am going to throw one in at the beginning, and that is, and this is pretty much just a gift to JP because he's had a rough morning, and I want to talk to him about this. But the new Siena poll is out, and I think there's some interesting things within the new Siena poll. Kathy Hochul continues to have a huge lead in the Democratic primary against Lieutenant Governor Antonio Delgado, and a significant lead over Representative Elise Stefanik in a general election matchup. That is since Elise Stefanik announced that she was indeed running for governor. What we should point out is last time Kathy Hochul was, I think, 25 points ahead of Elise, and now ahead by 20 points in this latest poll. But the one that really struck me, given what we've been hearing, and I think this is sort of a slow climb, but Kathy Hochul has a 52% approval rating, which ain't bad, right?
It's in this political environment, having an incumbent in a state like New York, which is, you know, there's always stuff going on and you're always getting blamed, you know, the affordability crisis and all that stuff. For her to have a 52% favorability rating is significant. It's also significant that she is right now up 20 points on Elise Stefanik. Elise Stefanik, like a lot of times when you are a Republican running in New York and your name is Mark Molinaro or your name is Carl Paladino, you basically, people don't know who you are. Elise Stefanik is someone who, because of her active role in the U.S. Congress and her active role with President Trump, she's someone who has a high name ID. People have an opinion of her. And for Governor Hochul to still be up 20 points on her is significant. I was thinking when this poll came out that it would be closer than the 20 points. Stefanik's campaign has been out over the past few weeks with some polls showing close, you know, internal polls showing a closer race, but Sienna is viewed as the, you know, nonpartisan, non-biased poll. Joe, you mentioned also Lieutenant Governor Delgado. After the Mamdani win in New York City, people were looking at Hochul as being potentially vulnerable to an insurgent primary. This poll has shown that that is not yet the case for Hochul. She, I'm sure, is taking Delgado's challenge seriously, but he is down, you know, dozens of points in the poll. Another unique part of the poll is seeing Mamdani's mayor-elect Zoran Mamdani's favorability statewide. You know, he just won election in New York City. He's got high favorability ratings in New York City.
In New York City, yeah.
Well above 50%. Statewide, 40-40. And statewide is, I would say that's not bad. You know, you might think that a Democratic socialist person named Zoran Mamdani might have negative approval ratings across the state, but for him to be even since he's been elected, I would say is numbers that he's probably generally pleased with. One other thing, sorry, Joe.
No.
One other thing.
As I said, this was my gift to you.
Yeah, thank you. It's a great gift. This is all
it's
I got.
It's a gift to us, too.
That's all I got. Is Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer has his lowest favorability ratings of his career.
And here's a fun game. Who's more unpopular, Donald Trump or Chuck Schumer? According to these numbers, it's Donald Trump, but still... it's what, 43% for Chuck Schumer, I believe. Is that correct? 45%. 45%.
Well, that's all right. So,
is that right?
Schumer, when they say the lowest of his tenure, worst ever favorability rating, 32% to 55%. So he's at 32% statewide.
Oh, he's at 32% statewide.
Yes.
Statewide.
I would have to. I don't know exactly what the. I'm looking at it right here, but of course I'm on.
Trump has a 35 to 61% favorable rating.
So Schumer's worse than Trump in his own home state. That's pretty bad. I guess it's Trump's home state too. But the problem with Schumer, unfortunately, is that so all the Republicans hate him. That's in the can. Then now the Democrats are upset with him because he is not, you know, the perception is that he's not standing up to Trump as well as he could, and he mismanaged the shutdown. And so now Democrats are also upset with Schumer. So he has bipartisan, you know, support for getting him out of there. The thing is, though, he is up for re-election in 2028. The thought is that he will not step down as minority leader, and that he may not run for re-election in 2028. That's kind of what the conventional wisdom is saying about Chuck right now.
And it's probably worth noting that, you know, the he's always been an inside baseball player, right? In other words, a lot of what Schumer does is that's effective is backspace, right? No, I mean I'm serious. Yeah. So for example, The you know, everyone's upset about how the shutdown went and things. The New York Times did have an editorial that was kind of, you know, this may have lost the battle but won the war. But the really interesting thing in that is some of the things about what we're going in the back room, that he convinced these folks not to settle before the election. So, in other words, he was really has a fair amount of control over the party. It's just he's not very good at expressing it in public. He doesn't come across as a demagogue who can really just tell you how it is, right? I mean, he's a very soft-spoken, quite every now and then he gives some kind of amazing talk, but most of the time he's just sort of explaining things, and That doesn't work well in politics.
I found it interesting, too. There's some the majority of voters opposing about a half dozen actions taken by Trump and his administration. Do you know, is this just of New Yorkers or is this across the country?
This is a statewide New York poll. And what the reason why they ask about that in New York State is because they want the tea leaves for 2026. How's the governor's race going to go? How are the congressional races? We've got six competitive congressional races statewide. And so we, as you know, basically can control the balance of power in Congress just in New York State. And so if the Democrats can flip three of those seats, four of those seats, that will have a huge impact on the balance of power nationally after next year.
So according to this poll, 64% oppose the demolition of the East Wing of the White House to build a new White House ballroom. 61% oppose putting increased tariffs on imports from virtually every country in the world. 53% oppose canceling federal funding that had been previously allocated to build the Gateway train tunnel between New York and New Jersey. 61% oppose deploying federal immigration officials such as ICE, often without uniforms, wearing masks, to the streets of American cities to round up illegal immigrants. 57% oppose prosecuting officials who have been critical to the president, such as Letitia James and James Comey. And 56% oppose, this is a topic we'll be talking about later, bombing boats in international waters that Trump says are Venezuelan drug dealers.
So this was the longest shutdown in U.S. history, but I don't think it's just frustration with the shutdown that is leading New York Democrats to be really frustrated with Schumer. That's not the only reason his poll ratings are so low. I think everyone knows he's theoretically the most powerful Democrat in government. Right. And
theoretically,
yes. And so I think a lot of people have seen the shutdown as the culmination of sort of a series of missed opportunities to show more leadership in a more public way. Jim's probably right about sort of the Schumer's strengths is more in the behind the scenes. It seems like a lot of Democrats in New York think like that's not what they need or want to see right now. So I think it's not just the shutdown that caused the poll numbers to be so low. It's people seeing that as the sort of the emblem of lack of Democratic strength in this moment. And because he's the leader of the Democratic Party, he has to bear the responsibility for that.
And you also saw what Mayor-elect Mamdani did, which is, you know, go against Andrew Cuomo and having these career politicians like a Chuck Schumer who's been around in an elective office for 40 or 50 years. I think there's a general sentiment both on the left and the right of it's time to bring in some new fresh faces to our leadership, both in City Hall and in the Congress.
We're going to take a break. We will return and talk more about this topic and others after this break.
If the best days that we'll know are just in the past, are we gonna last forever? I want more best days.
Welcome back to the program. Lissy is the music we just heard, playing Bearsville Theater in Woodstock on Saturday the 22nd. You can find out more by going to Bearsville Theater. BearsvilleTheater.com. Most recent release is an EP of covers entitled Promises. You can see the playlist posted on our website, wamc.org/roundtable. wamc.org/roundtable. Again, BearsvilleTheater.com to find out more about Lissy playing at the Bearsville Theater on the 22nd. All right. Let's go to a couple of letters on this. Listening to the discussion of favorability ratings for Chuck Schumer and others, I'm curious about Gillibrand's standing in the state. She is super low in my favorability rating. I do not think she's been at all effective in supporting her constituents against Trump's moves, and particularly in facing the ICE and border security aggressions. Is she mentioned in the I did not see Gillibrand in the poll.
I think they what they do is they have, because these polls, they can't just ask about everybody. Mamdani, Schumer, Hochul, Stefanik, Trump. And I think Gillibrand gets asked either twice a year or three or four times a year. She because she's less high profile than Schumer, my belief is that her approval ratings are higher because she's just not as much of a lightning rod. I think Democrats are less upset with her than they are with Schumer, and Republicans probably are also less upset with her than they are with Schumer.
All right, so let me just check this. Gillibrand approval rating. I'll look this up for Pam. See what we come up with. And
include Siena in there because they will have done it recently.
Yes. And in April, that was the last time they did it. Approval rating was mixed. 36% of New York registered voters gave her job approval as excellent or good, while 42% rated it as fair or poor.
She's 4% better than Chuck. Yeah, so she's not doing great either.
That gives you an idea. And that's April. That's April. So just keep that in mind. But there you go. I hope that helps, Pam. But thank you for the question. We go to Travis. The Democrats had the House, Senate, and presidency, yet failed to ratify health care or anything to help low-income people indefinitely. Why and what would they do differently if they get all three again? Who wants that question?
Wait, I'm confused by the question.
The question is, our listener is, the writer is asking that because now the Republicans have the House, the Senate, and the presidency. He's saying that the Democrats had that, yet failed to ratify health care or do anything to help.
Let's see. They extended the Obama credits. They passed the Infrastructure Reform Act. They did, various other, I'd have to go back and look at the actual legislation, bunch of regulatory things that got thrown out the minute Trump became president. If you heard the story today about the teddy bear, the AI-based teddy bear who will give your kid information on, like, how to find and light matches, where the kitchen knives are kept, will tell your three-year-old sexually explicit stories, things like that. The guardrails that were making it so you couldn't sell such things were approved by the Democrats and sold out on day two, I think, of the Trump administration when he removed all the AI regulations. So
I think
it's
that
not like they did nothing.
Yeah, but I think that letter is expressing a sentiment that is common among Democrats, and that's why their approval ratings are so low. So despite what you've just pointed out, Jim, a lot of people aren't seeing that, not thinking about it, are focused on higher profile topics where the Democrats haven't achieved as much as their base wants them to achieve. And so I think there's this sort of anti-incumbency or anti-older incumbent. I mean, so I think Chuck Schumer also suffers in comparison right now to Nancy Pelosi, who is bowing out gracefully. It just begs the question in a lot of people's minds about what he's going to do, and why should people continue to support him when the leadership just hasn't really manifested during this time?
Right, but I think this question was when the Democrats had the three houses, why didn't they do anything?
Well, why give him another shot? I think.
Yeah, the answer is they did do a lot of things, and then. Remember, it was Democrat for 4 years, then it was Republican for 4 years, then it was Democrats for 2 years, and then it was a mixed, the Democrats couldn't do anything for the last 2 years. So, it's quite a confused picture of exactly who did what and when. But, my personal belief, Jay, you can probably tell me more than if I'm right or wrong about this, but our economy would have been in a lot worse shape coming out of COVID if we hadn't had the people we had in office. And that was what was the primary concern of the first couple years of when the Democrats did control everything is, healthcare was getting ready to spike out of control. So, part of the problem is prices went up. They didn't double, right? That's not seen as an accomplishment, right. But, you know, again, I think there was a lot. And to be honest, I'm sounding very partisan. I think there were mistakes they made. I think they could have been more effective. Certainly the early Obama years, he was laser focused on health care. Everything, I was involved in the White House back in those days, and it's like everything else, we would get a note that said, that's really important. The day after health care, we'll start discussing it, right? So, yeah, I mean, I think there could have been more. I think the optics weren't as good as they could have been. I think, you know, we now know Biden was not at his best and a riveting speaker, even when he was at his healthiest.
It's also a little bit of the design of our democracy that even when one party controls the White House and the House and the Senate, that they don't just have carte blanche to enact anything they want.
Sure.
The Senate has to get 60 votes. The House, with a very evenly split House, it's very hard to get a majority there. And so you see with in Trump's first year, it's been limited as to how much the Republicans have accomplished as opposed to what they want to accomplish. Same thing with Biden in his first 2 years and Obama in his first 2 years. And you overwhelmingly see that after the first 2 years in the midterm, you will likely see, Democrats do a lot better at both in the U.S. Senate and the Congress as the Republicans did during Biden's first midterm.
Let's go back to letters. We go to hold on here. I'm also trying to order one of those teddy bears.
you can borrow mine.
Yeah. Okay. Excellent.
I won't mention the name of it. Although suffice.
Oh, I found
suffice
it.
To say, it's made by a company that there is also an issue. Oh, among other things, it also listens to everything said in your house. It identifies your child's face. Voice, knows who their friends are, is connected to the internet, so you start getting, personalized advertising aimed at your kid on your smart television. Just little things like that.
David writes to us and says the Democrats pulled their punches in power. They pulled their punches out of power. Why give them primacy in your mind when seeking actual change? That is David's note titled "It Isn't Confusing." Mike,
David, who is your alternative?
Mike writes to us and says Chuck Schumer and Zohran Mamdani present an interesting contrast in political philosophy. At the beginning of the current Trump administration, Schumer articulated a do-nothing Democratic strategy. That is, give Trump and Republicans enough rope to hang themselves with. Two problems. Intervening behind the scenes on the shutdown was a failure to hold to this approach. And more importantly, this entire philosophy treats material problems with mere abstractions. It's detached from people's reality, economic and anxiety. One of the first things Mamdani did after Trump won the 2024 election was to get out in the street and interview people in New York City who voted for Trump. He then crafted a platform directly responding to their stated positions. Which style of politics seems more viable? That question from Mike. We go to Isla, who says, I'm so tired of panelists equivocating and being, and having your amnesia about Democratic claims versus performance. Seriously, guys, do better. All right.
I apologize. I've clearly been hallucinating.
It's hard to remember what's
No, but I will say there is a difference, okay?
Yeah.
I think if he was getting it. The Democrats played by the rules. So for example, a lot of people are angry that Merrick Garland, including me, that Merrick Garland wasn't more aggressive in some of his prosecutions things. But Garland's belief was the Justice Department stays separate from politics and is very, very careful about any case that can have political implications, right? Compare that to the current Justice Department, which is, yes, sir, whatever you say, Mr. President, sir. Now, that yes, sir, whatever you say, Mr. President, sir, is not what's happened for the past 245 years of our democracy. It's only happened during the times of a few different, very despotic leaders. And, you know, so that's the other thing. So I think when you played by the rules, the American system is designed to move slowly and be fair. I can date this all the way back to the Constitution, which really was you had six states who wanted it to go one way, six states who wanted it to go the other way, and one little state in the middle that was helping to sort of broker a constitution so that neither side would ever really win.
Well, yeah, and the Democrats would have accomplished more had they broken the filibuster and eliminated the filibuster a few years ago. But where would that place us now? That would allow Republicans to run roughshod and pass all they want. So these things where are you more frustrated that your party didn't do more when they were in power, or are you less frustrated that the party you oppose can't do as much as they want to?
All right, let's take a break. When we come back, we'll change subjects. We'll move on, and we welcome you, panel at WAMC.org, to weigh in as well. Panel at WAMC.org. We'll be right back.
Could make me love you less. I'll stand by you. I'll stand by you. Won't let nobody hurt you. I'll stand by you.
Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. Moving on to other issues this morning. And we welcome you, as always, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. We go to the, I wanted to talk about the Venezuela plans, and Trump says he won't rule out sending troops into Venezuela. This is a story that we have covered sort of on and off over the last several weeks. President, this is from the Washington Post. President Donald Trump said Monday that he will not rule out the possibility of sending U.S. troops into Venezuela as a buildup of U.S. forces in the region. And his increasingly combustible rhetoric raises the prospect of military action there. I don't rule out anything. We just have to take care of Venezuela, Trump said when asked at a news conference about putting American personnel on the ground in Venezuela. Trump's remarks in the Oval Office appeared at odds with the claim Sunday night that the administration may be having some discussions with Nicolas Maduro, Venezuela's strongman president, whom Trump has repeatedly vilified as an armada of U.S. warships has been assembled in the Caribbean Sea in recent weeks. Trump has accused Maduro of leading a narcotics organization and said he is responsible for sending drugs and violent criminals to the United States of America. In his conversation with reporters late Sunday, Trump indicated that the Venezuelan leader would like to talk and that the U.S. may be willing to listen, suggesting a diplomatic off-ramp may exist. In response to Trump late Monday, Maduro said he was willing to have face-to-face discussions with U.S. representatives. Separately, we hear from the president yesterday saying that he is not ruling out the possibility of sending U.S. troops into Venezuela. So,
yippee. Okay. All right. Well, the president continues to these are negotiating tactics from him. The problem is that, I mean, it's force posture is has enormous international implications beyond just whatever deal he's trying to strike with Maduro. So they've decided to move an aircraft carrier off the coast as well, which is I'm just agog at that. So the United States has 11 aircraft carriers. That's a legal requirement that Congress had imposed a long time ago. And because of the way it works so that they have to rotate in and out of port, about a third of those can be deployed at any one time. And so usually there's one in the Middle East and you have one or two in the Pacific. The Pacific's a very big ocean, so it takes a long time to get away across the Pacific. So I don't know the last time I sorry, I should have looked it up before I got here. The last time a U.S. aircraft carrier was deployed in the Caribbean, the kind of power that that represents, aircraft carriers are about force projection. That means sort of in a place where you don't have land-based facilities that you can project U.S. forces off of that platform, whether it's by air because they have all the planes on board, or you're landing Marines to have a land force go in somewhere. I mean, that's what they're for. So when I hear about these negotiating tactics and the fact we have an aircraft carrier now in the Caribbean, it really makes me worry about our posture in other areas of the world, because we have so few of these. People might be surprised to hear me say, like, we have so few of these resources with a defense budget the size we have. But it's true. There are really only four aircraft carriers around the world at any one time. A decision was made by multiple administrations, over the past decade and a half that the United States really needed to focus more on trying to support peace and stability in the Pacific. And that's where a lot of our force posture, and especially our naval resources like aircraft carriers, have been sent. When one of those is pulled and sent to the Caribbean instead, it enables the kind of really destabilizing and dangerous bullying tactics we've seen from the Chinese, who are taking over islands and removing Vietnamese and Philippine fishermen and just using really dangerous tactics to expand their influence in that part of the world. And I happen to think that those national security decisions that, again, were made over the past 15 years were the right ones, that a lot of the global economy and global peace and stability is tied to what happens in the Pacific, in the Malacca Straits in Southeast Asia. To remove some of our ability to help maintain the stability of that area in order to support, I don't really understand what the president is trying to accomplish with Venezuela, other than their oil reserves there, but that doesn't fully explain it for me. I'm confused and concerned by what this enables to happen in other areas of the world.
So, and Joe, let me just expand one thing on what Leah said, because when you send an aircraft carrier, you don't send one ship.
Right.
It is the biggest ship, but it's surrounded by a set of support ships. So so the carrier fleet that gets sent there includes, I used to know exactly the number and makeup and stuff, but it's been a few years since I was involved in that stuff. But so you're hearing things like he's sending a flotilla, he's sending a bunch of ships. And the answer is yes, because the aircraft carrier comes with those ships that can protect the aircraft carrier, but even more importantly, the ships that can get closer to shore for actual battle fighting, because the aircraft carrier basically is launching planes, right? Not launching troops, but the things that come with it have the ability to get closer in and do it. So it's really scary. And you know what I would suggest, Joe, I would assume I'm allowed to do this, is I think everybody should go out, and whether you can watch it on tons and tons of streaming services, watch the movie Wag the Dog, right? It's a 1997 movie about a president who gets in trouble over a sex scheme and manipulates and creates a fake military engagement to move the U.S. in his favor. It's exaggerated, but, oh, man, when you just look at what's going on now and you look at this, imagine how many Epstein stories are going to be on the front page if the U.S. is actually in a shooting war in Venezuela.
That's a great point, Jim. It's hard to know whether he's really focused on it being a drug operation or whether it's regime change. And it's confusing because he's been in office for a long time. You know, if you go back to his previous term, and he's never been a regime change guy. And he's also been a guy who, you know, likes the dictators, right? And likes the strong men and typically tends to buddy up to them. So I agree that it's puzzling what his motivation is and what his end goal is. And it's something that I'm trying to think of. Have we seen him do a military buildup elsewhere in the world? I'm trying to think of whether we have. And my view is the answer is no.
This is the first major, I mean, other than inside our own country sending, but that's,
yeah,
that's
a good point.
Relatively small numbers, but that's small comfort, sending the National Guard to Chicago and Washington, D.C. and other places. So this is a huge, I mean, the amount of effort and resources that goes into sending an and Jim's absolutely right. It's not just the carrier itself. It's like it's a fleet, basically, to the Caribbean is enormous, enormous, enormous.
Right. We have something like 15 or 16,000 troops down there now.
You mean in South America?
As part of this.
I mean, the U.S. has a small number of. Bases like Sotocano, I believe, in Honduras, but generally U.S. military action or presence in South America has been, I mean, compared to where we are in other parts of the world, pretty limited. I mean,
right.
You know, we have huge bases in Germany and the U.K. and Italy and even Turkey you know, on behalf of all the listeners, you, the American taxpayers, the U.S. government has been maintaining those bases for a long time, but not so much in South America. The military presence there has been more military diplomats who are in U.S. embassies around the region, and so this is a huge change, and I hope we have some listeners writing in who maybe have a background of being from Latin America and can share more about what this looks like from their perspective, because there's a lot of complicated history there. I'm not sure that the president really I'm sure he doesn't know about that history, and even if he did, he probably that's not what he's concerned about.
And I do think it plays into the immigration. We should probably talk about that when we come back.
All right. We'll take a break. We'll continue our conversation. We welcome you. Panel at WAMC.org. Panel at WAMC.org. We'll continue after this break and news from WAMC. Well, good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion for this Tuesday morning. A delight to have you with us. And let me just say, it's we have a great group here. Malia Dumont is with us. Jim Hendler is with us. J.P. Miller is with us. We welcome you, panel at WAMC.org. Let me go over to Jim, who was ready to ask Malia a question before we went to break, and I will let that happen, and then we'll go on to other topics.
So Malia, my question is, you know, we have something called the War Powers Act, which, you know, folks on the radio can look it up, but basically the president is limited in how much he can do in terms of commuting troops and doing things. However, that's been questioned, and boundaries have been pushed out over the years. And of course, Trump is known for that boundary pushing, and then say, you want to sue me, take it to my Supreme Court. But if the president ends up doing military action in Venezuela, and for reasons I don't understand, the blowing up of these boats that he's been doing hasn't counted as military action. But now that you have a force, now that he's really threatening boots on the ground, if that does start, right, how much extra power does he have? How much ability does that give him to move money around, to change some of the things he's been talking about, et cetera?
Look, I think there are good reasons why a president needs to retain some ability to move troops around without needing to go to Congress for everything.
Sure.
That's, you know, war is an emergency. But look, we were in Afghanistan for over 20 years, and Congress never declared war there. And that was obviously that was an outgrowth of the response to 9/11. And then it became sort of a fait accompli that Congress never voted for war because there was really nothing to go to war against specifically in Afghanistan. But they voted many times to fund the military presence there. And so I think given the way this Congress has followed the president, generally speaking, that he has a lot of latitude to, you know, take what action he thinks is necessary. And then this Congress, the Republican members of this Congress, I think would line up to support it and say, oh, this needs to be funded, or similar to how we saw it in Afghanistan, for example. So that's probably not what you hope
that's
the reality.
No, that's what I wanted to clarify because, you know, I think there's two aspects of this. One is, of course, how often will we hear about the Epstein case? Should there be a, quote, shooting war, unquote? But the other one is really we've seen the president using his powers inside the country to move troops around to do a lot of things. Now he's doing that outside, and Venezuela would be an odd place for that to be where it goes down. But one could see that it gives Trump a very strong position in you know, I don't even know how to describe it exactly. In other words, when we're at war, typically the country pulls together more. The country tends to support things more. But it would require him actually coming up with a really good reason
why. Like, typically when the country's – I mean, as someone who spent a year of my life in Afghanistan and people forgot where I was, like, I have never personally experienced that. And for my friends who deployed to Iraq, I don't think they necessarily – felt it either.
This is true.
There's a whole discussion we could have about civil military relations in America, but just to clarify one thing you talked about. So the moving troops around inside the United States, the deployment of National Guard, that's not actually under Trump's authority. It's a different kind of power he's wielding there. It's the power of his influence. He did not order those troops specifically. It's the governors of those states. Because that's how it starts. National Guard cannot be federalized or moved to another state without, well, the governors offered it. I mean. So the troops in Chicago came from Texas, and this was something the governor of Texas saw as politically expedient for him to call up. I mean, it's a relatively small number. I think it's about 200 or 300 troops. And then I'm sure the president requested it, but the governors offered this as well. So I think the governor of Kentucky as well.
Yeah, but the governor, right. I mean, yeah. The governor of the state.
So
this
is another way that I think like Republican leaders at various levels across the country have been trying to show that they support Trump by offering things, by doing things that, he didn't need to take a lot of action with troops. They sort of did it for him in that case. So,
all right, let's move on to just a couple of letters on this topic, and then we will move on. Let's see. We go to I had it. There we go. Skip says, regarding Venezuela, who won the Peace Prize this year? Where was she from? Maybe that's the answer. Okay. Prize this year, of course, went to Maria Corina Machado, former deputy of the National Assembly of Venezuela. So I think drawing conclusions there. Then we go to this letter from Dave. Trump regards Venezuela as his, whereas Ukraine belongs to Putin, for example, or Taiwan to China. This controls how he reacts to those countries' interactions with these dictators. That from Dave. Then we got this note saying, I was watching from Frank. I was watching Ken Burns' American Revolution documentary and noted that the Continental Congress had to give George Washington, as a general, time-limited authority in the midst of war to do his job. There was constant review under that rubric how far we've lowered our standards. That from Frank. And I believe I have one more. Yes, Sarah writes, the Caribbean boat strikes are murder and our system has failed to stop them. Trump's administration has killed at least 83 people in strikes on boats in the Caribbean and the Pacific. The UN calls these extrajudicial executions that violate international law. This is unconscionable. It's also not new. Bush pioneered drone killings post 9/11, establishing the war on terror framework that treated the entire globe as a battlefield. Obama industrialized it, conducting 10 times more strikes than Bush, killing between 384 to 807 civilians in Pakistan, Somalia, and Yemen alone, including American citizens, a 16-year-old American boy, wedding parties, a grandmother gathering vegetables. Congress, including Democrats, have been complicit throughout. They cheered drone strikes under Obama, passed authorizations enabling this, and now offer only rhetorical opposition to Trump while failing to use their constitutional war powers to stop him. The courts have largely declined to intervene. Until we dismantle the legal architecture enabling any president to kill anywhere based solely on executive determination, this will continue. That is a great letter. It's also an example of a letter that's too long. I just want that as an example.
It was a great letter.
But it was a great letter, which is why we let it in.
Made an exception.
I didn't want to, but I just don't want people to get the idea. But Sarah did a great job on that letter. And I didn't
it was a beautiful letter.
All right. Let's move on to other points here. And let me see. We go to everything all right? There's pointing in the studio. I didn't know what was going on. I'm sorry.
Joe immediately believes there's a breaking story.
Yes. I didn't know.
About.
You have to be careful. Hey, Larry Sumner, Summers is ashamed over the Epstein ties, and he steps back from public commitments. I find this story just fascinating. I find it silly, but I find it nothing silly about what he did or what was in there. But the way that you make up for something that could be horrible is to just say, "I'm going to stay home." I didn't know that was one of the options. New emails have shown that Mr. Summers, a former Harvard president, had stayed in touch with Jeffrey Epstein for years after he faced sex trafficking charges. Larry Summers, a former Treasury Secretary, let us not forget, said Monday that he would be stepping back from public commitments following the release of emails between him and Jeffrey Epstein, a convicted sex offender. He did apologize. He said, "I'm deeply ashamed of my actions and recognized the pain they have caused," Mr. Summers said in a statement Monday. "I take full responsibility for my misguided decision to continue communicating with Mr. Epstein." Mr. Summers added that he would continue teaching as an economics professor at Harvard, though he did not specify which public commitments he would be stepping back from. The Yale Budget Lab said Mr. Summers has indicated that he would be withdrawing from his role in its advisory group. The Hamilton Project, an economics policy arm of Brookings Institution, said the same. A spokeswoman for the Center for American Progress, a left-leaning think tank, said Mr. Summers would be ending his fellowship there immediately.
Well, so go ahead.
No, go ahead, JP.
Well, so this is as a result of Senator Elizabeth Warren, the senior, I guess she is the senior senator from Massachusetts now, calling on Harvard to sever ties with Larry Summers. And so his response is, well, I'm going to be pulling back my public commitments. Well, as far as Harvard is concerned, he is still an economics professor at Harvard, and Elizabeth Warren still says that Harvard should sever their ties with him. So it will be interesting to see in the coming days whether Harvard removes him, whether they, I don't know what ability they have to remove him if he's a longstanding.
He's a tenured professor.
So you both work in colleges. Do they have the ability to remove him or no?
Yes, but not easily. And it has to be for a very specific cause. So if, for example, he was named in the Epstein letters as having been one of the offenders and is taken to court, then the college is generally forced to either defend him or say, I'm sorry, you know, this is a violation of college policies, blah, 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 you got to go. It's non-trivial. The joke used to be if you want to get fired with tenure, you have to sleep with the president's daughter. But that's no longer the case because now we have a lot of women who are done and a lot of gay people. So now it's just sleeping with any of the president's family. But seriously, the number of things that, you know, the level of misconduct that requires firing is high. Resignation, though, is often, if you'll agree to resign, we won't go through this process, which means you get to keep your retirement and your things like that. So, you know, I would be surprised if he was fired. I would be much less surprised if he ends up resigning in a couple of weeks.
And he might technically remain on the faculty, but not actually teach anything.
Yeah, that's another
possibility. So that's.
You don't think Harvard will take him out, Senator Elizabeth Warren says they should sever ties, that Harvard won't or can't?
I think it's a combination of both.
Yes.
So I signed up to receive updates from a Harvard alumni group called Crimson Courage. Got my master's degree there. I haven't been super involved with the school, but with all the attacks on higher education from the federal government, there's a substantial group of Harvard alumni very disappointed, to put it mildly, in how the school, which is probably the most famous university in the world, right, and incredibly influential, and has an endowment of, you know, larger than many countries. So this is an institution with world power. And so a lot of alumni were very, very upset that Harvard wasn't stepping up to be more of a leader. And so they formed this group called Crimson Courage to encourage Harvard to take more of a stand. And I'll bet that this group, I haven't heard from them specifically on this topic, but this is the kind of thing where they'll be trying to push the administration, I'm guessing, to cut ties with Larry Summers. Tangential point, as the daughter of two professors, I do have to speak up in defense of the concept of tenure because I know it's often misunderstood, and these kind of cases where someone has done or said something truly objectionable are actually pretty rare. Tenure is there to enable academic freedom because. If you're a tenured professor, then you're not. You can really say what you think. You can pursue your research. You don't have to depend on pleasing your boss. That's the general concept. And it's obviously unusual. There aren't any other places really besides American higher education where this kind of concept endures. And so I think it's often misunderstood. But that's the purpose of it, and that's why it continues. And that's why, for example, the American Association of University Professors, despite these rare cases like, you know, Larry Summers, continues, and rightfully so, to really vigorously defend tenure.
Yeah. And I mean, you know, just to be clear, and that's across the board. So, you know, in a political science department or something like that, these things seem more obvious. But for example, there have been cases where one of the university professors would like to pursue developing some research. Well, I'll give you a real example. Some of the mRNA research that was funded, there were people who were saying, we're not sure this is a good idea, right? The faculty members who did the first breakthroughs and eventually won prizes, like Nobel Prizes, passed that on to drug companies who developed things that now go in vaccines like the COVID vaccine. So, but they also had other ethical considerations, right? So again, the professors being allowed to decide that, yes, we understand the boundaries, but we think we're playing within these boundaries and we want to go this direction. And the administration not being able to say, okay, you can't do that, is an important part of academic freedom that's not as political, but happens, you know, is really another of the reasons why tenure is very important. In fact, my being on this radio show would probably be very dangerous if I didn't have tenure.
Meanwhile, outside of Boston, regarding the Epstein vote, in fact, House Speaker Mike Johnson is speaking right now about the vote, calling it a political show vote. But the House is expected to overwhelmingly approve this afternoon a bill demanding that the Justice Department release all files related to its investigation into the convicted sex offender Jeffrey Epstein, a one-time friend of President Trump. Mr. Trump, who pushed hard to head off the vote by declaring that supporting it would be considered a hostile act, caved to pressure from his party and said he would support the bill. As far as the future of the bill, one of the bill's Republican sponsors, Representative Thomas Massie, urged senators not to muck it up and pass the measure. Mr. Trump has said he would sign it even though he could release the files without Congress, even if the bill becomes law. Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene, another Republican, raised the possibility that the Justice Department may keep the files tied up in the investigation. Mr. Trump has demanded into Mr. Epstein's connections to Democrats. So that is all going on as this also the Larry Summers side of the story. But much more on this today, of course, as the House looks to vote on it and then it heads to the Senate and we'll see what happens from there. Anyone in the last 30 seconds before we go to a break?
I'll just say I'm tired of hearing about Larry Summers. This is not the first time that he has popped up in the news, having said or done something that's like kind of despicable. It was years ago that he talked about, I forget the exact quote, but basically disparaging female scientists or intimating that they weren't able to do science as well as their male counterparts. And I think he's in a sense a dinosaur from the previous generation of university administrators, like the older white guy who just is tone deaf.
We'll take a break. When we come back, we'll continue the discussion and finish up our program. Jim Hendler is here, J.P. Miller, and Malia Dumont. We welcome your letters, as we always do. All you have to do is write to us. You can keep them, keep your letters short to the point. Panel@WAMC.org, panel@WAMC.org. We will continue our conversation after this break in news from the BBC. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion for this Tuesday morning. Now we have time for one or two more segments, and I'd like to get to these issues. The federal judge has blasted the potential government misconduct in the Comey case. And I've wanted to talk about this for a while, but I'm glad I waited because now there's this new information, and I think it's quite interesting. A federal judge on Monday offered a blistering assessment of the Justice Department's case against former FBI Director James Comey, detailing what he described as a disturbing pattern of profound investigative missteps. Sounds bad. And possible misconduct that could imperil the prosecution. U.S. Magistrate Judge William Fitzpatrick criticized authorities for their cavalier attitude toward the rights of Comey and others. Lindsey Halligan, the Trump-appointed U.S. attorney overseeing the case, also appeared to have made, quote, fundamental misstatements of the law to the grand jury that indicted Comey on charges of lying to Congress. This, according to the judge. Those irregularities potentially undermine the integrity of the grand jury proceeding, Fitzpatrick said. He ordered the Justice Department to hand over full transcripts of those proceedings to the defense. Late Monday, the federal district judge overseeing the Comey case temporarily paused Fitzpatrick's order at the Justice Department's request. U.S. Judge Michael Nachmanoff said he would review Fitzpatrick's decision and decide in the coming days whether to uphold it. Here we go.
So last summer I got to sit on the grand jury. And, you know, it was interesting, went through a lot of cases. In almost every case we agreed with the person presenting because, by and large, you only see what they want you to see. And there was only one that was contested, and what really was over was you are told exactly what the law is and how to interpret it in terms of the meaning of every word and things like that. And there was one case where we felt that there was ambiguity. We asked them back in, you're allowed to do that, to clarify it. She had to go out to get a senior person who came in to say, I can't tell you, you must, you know, here are the exact words, you figure it out, right? So if she had answered the question wrong, right, and we had voted to convict, that would have given the person who was being convicted, a real and legitimate reason to say we did something wrong. This whole case has been so bizarre, and the person who's presented to the grand jury had never done it before, and on and on and on. Usually, for a high-profile case, there's two or three people there.
That's where the cavalier attitude comes in, I think.
Exactly. And so, you know, I suspect what we're going to see in the Comey case is mistake after mistake after mistake that just lets it keep dragging on and keeps it in the news, which is to Trump's advantage, and then we'll see the same thing happen with the Letitia James case. There's already, apparently, in the James case, questions over whether the person who did the, you know, who came up with the evidence was even legally allowed to see it, and on and on. You know, I mean, the Justice Department has become a wholly owned branch of the Trump administration. I don't think anyone disputes that these days. Pretty much everyone in the that's not true. Many of the Justice Department employees who couldn't stomach that have either retired or quit. So it's a completely different group of people than it was a year ago. The Justice Department is a pyramid where we're hearing about the top, but it has implications all the way down. You know, one example is a bunch of Justice Department, this just broke last night, a bunch of Justice Department employees who were trained in child sex trafficking cases were pursuing one of the largest cases in a very long time, were called off of that case and told, your job now is to help ICE in court, right? Some of them quit. Some of them went with ICE. A lot of them are sitting there literally in their off hours still working on the child trafficking case because they want to protect the particular kid and the many other kids who've been abused. And so this gets down so far and has such implications that we're always just talking about the very top, and, you know, did they do Comey right? And miss the fact that those same decisions that are pulling people around and moving the Justice Department to just do what Trump wants has real implications on our day-to-day lives in terms of law enforcement. I don't mean so much the police, but I mean the FBI, the DHS, the Special Investigation Forces, anyone who's ever watched CSI or any of those. These are the people we're talking about. And, you know, they're being redeployed. They're being moved around. And to me, this is one of the big abuses of the Trump Department.
Yeah, I agree. And, you know, with all of its flaws, I believe in America, in the American justice system, and the way that it has been abused and turned to the wrong kind of purposes is highly dangerous for our democracy. It's not just a policy issue. And so I hope that much as Republicans spent the Biden presidency preparing Project 2025 for what they were going to do, I hope that Democrats are planning for, you know, what are they going to do if and when they get back into power to put more protections around the Department of Justice, because it really needs to remain much more sacrosanct than it has been. The other thing I'll say about this case is that I think it shows, among other things, how difficult it can be when you're a defendant to get access to the right information.
Yes.
I'm not sure exactly how it came to this judge's attention that that this case needed to be reviewed. That the defense didn't even have I didn't know that the defense doesn't get a transcript of the grand jury proceedings where their client has been indicted. I mean, I'm not a lawyer, so but. How can you prepare an adequate defense if you don't have access to that information? That they had to go in front of a judge to get it. It seems like not a lot of defendants would have those resources to be able to delve into the system in this way.
Yeah, I'm shocked that they think it's a good idea to have someone who's never prosecuted a case before to go and try and prosecute the former FBI director, James Comey. It just you read this article and you see these mistakes that were made that I'm not a lawyer either, but you'd think that any reasonable prosecuting attorney wouldn't make these mistakes and would have a team with them. And it's hard to imagine that this case isn't going to get dismissed before trial. You know, the judge that they're coming up in front of, Nakmahotas, I'm probably pronouncing that wrong. It sounds like he has the ability and discretion to dismiss the case at this point. He was appointed by President Biden, and it seems to me like people think that there's a good possibility it could be dismissed right now.
But I wonder if that's part of the strategy, not getting it dismissed, but creating as messy of a legal process as possible.
Yeah.
So it might be dismissed, but James Comey, or in another proceeding, whoever the defendant is in that case, has to go through this whole process and spend the money on the lawyers, and their, you know, their life is upended in the meantime. So I suspect that they don't really care. That's why they assigned this person who had no experience. It's I think that's part of how they prioritize.
And
these
remember,
things.
One minute warning. Go ahead.
Two experienced DAs assigned to the case said there's not evidence to indict. Were fired. Well, one was fired. One was quote resigned. And then this person has been charged. So again, you know, the political clown show continues. And as you say, I think this administration would like nothing better than for this to stay in the headlines for as long as possible.
We are out of time. I want to thank our wonderful group this morning for being with us and sharing their insights. Jim Hendler, J.P. Miller, Malia Dumont, thank you very much for being here. We'll continue on the roundtable. Stay tuned after this.